The Thirsty Developer, episode number 19 for April 17th, 2008. Talking web application scalability with Richard Campbell.
Today we had a great time up at DeepRun.net in Milwaukee about a week and a half ago. We got to see some great speakers like, Mark Miller and a couple of guys from the Microsoft product team. We also got to see Richard Campbell speak, and, he's a good buddy of yours. You guys are old friends. And, he's also the president of Strange Loop Technologies, or I think he's the founder and product evangelist of Strange Loop. And they focus on ASP.NET scalability.
Yeah, that was actually, Richard's, session at the DeepRun.net event up in Milwaukee. Essentially, Richard's he's always been a server guy. He always likes to figure out how to make applications scale and how to make them better, faster, and more maintainable, as well as being able to perform better. So we grabbed a couch in the lounge there at the hotel. We had a chance to sit down with Richard and talk to him about, what developers can do to build scalable web applications.
Yeah, he's just kind of a fountain of knowledge. Should we just roll the tape and see what he's got to say?
Absolutely.
So, Dave, it's kind of a weird situation at DeepRun.net. We're in the bar of the Marriott here, and you and I are recording a podcast with Richard Campbell.
Sir Richard Campbell.
I haven't been knighted yet. Thanks, guys. I am a Canadian, so that is a possibility.
I don't know what it is, Richard. Every time I see you or see you speak, your presence among you, I just want to call you Sir Richard Campbell.
Oh, that's
for
some reason.
I'm not sure why. It just, just popped in today when I saw you up on stage this afternoon, so...
You know, the funny part about conference speaking, and Scott Isaacs came up afterwards and said, "Wow, it seems like you may have done that before." yeah, you know what? I've been on stage doing technical talking for 12 years. So, yeah, I've done it a bunch of times. It makes me pretty comfortable.
Yeah, so actually, I think the first time I met you, Richard, was actually at Ken Getz's house in L.A.
Right, right.
It was like
a PDC party.
Yeah, it was PDC. It might have been... Was it 2003 or might have been a little bit before that?
Yeah, even before
and,
that.
And I remember you distinctively because for whatever reason, you were literally holding court. You're sitting down on a bench. I mean, Ken Getz had an amazing house in LA.
Beautiful house, yeah.
And I just remember he was, the kind of the hillside there, and he had a beautiful backyard kind of patio deck, situation out there. And there's a bench, and you're kind of sitting there. People kept up coming up to you, talking to you. And I think you were talking about Istanbul. And I'm just like, who is this guy? I mean, this guy is, yeah, great stories to tell. And so maybe that's where the whole Sir Knighthood comes into play.
Maybe, yeah, okay. I mean, I do like traveling a lot, but I think I come from a family of storytellers, too. Like, that's something I happen to enjoy doing. If you ever get an opportunity to talk to my mother, you'll find out I'm not an anomaly in my family. I think crafting and telling a good tale is something we enjoy doing. And so, I mean, the best thing about traveling is having those experiences and then, telling a good story around them is part of the fun.
Right. So, I mean, yeah, you've definitely been all over the world. I mean, you're, co-host of .NET Rocks, obviously. And
yeah.
So you always kind of wheeled in some stories and discussion there. So you got some interesting places you're coming up, actually, with, traveling over to Eastern Europe.
Yeah. Eastern Europe has been my fixation lately, the past couple of years, Eastern Europe and Middle East. But this past January, I got an opportunity to go to Lithuania, of all things.
I can't even spell Lithuania.
Well, how many opportunities are you going to get to go? It's just a little country, but I just love immersing myself in something like that where you're so incredibly a foreigner.
Right.
And we don't think about it when we were kids. That was just part of the Soviet bloc, but they see it as an occupation.
Right.
They talk about the Soviet occupation after World War II until 1991. And so just embracing that sort of culture of the way they see the world was absolutely the best part about going. Even though it was only for a week,
you
got really a chance to feel what it was like to be in Lithuania.
Right. Like I was telling you earlier, I said the only time I've been outside the country, I'm kind of sheltered myself, right? Growing up in the Midwest. The only time I've been out of the country is Toronto and Cancun, and that doesn't really count.
Yeah, you haven't left NAFTA.
When you get on NAFTA, then it counts. But
things get a little different.
That's right. But this isn't a travel podcast.
Yeah.
But, Toronto is like the Miami Beach of Canada, right?
No, I think that's Victoria, actually. But
well, you live in Vancouver, which is the San Diego of Canada.
I that would be fair. Vancouver, very much the San Diego of Canada.
Yeah, well, we're not going to turn this into a travel podcast, right? We're still sticking with Thirsty Developer.
We're in trouble now.
So we're going to go down the rat hole pretty quickly here. But actually, so what we want to talk to you today is kind of the talk that you had this afternoon at Deeper.net here in Milwaukee. It's just kind of about building scalable web applications.
Right. Well, this is a topic near to my heart. I've done it long before .NET. .NET. Most of the work that I was doing out in the field was working with companies that were building large-scale web apps with ASP and other technologies and ultimately into .NET as well. But Strange Loop's what's really driven all of that. So the experience with Strange Loop just got us so focused on what's scaling all about.
And for the listeners, Strange Loop is?
So Strange Loop Networks is a company that myself and several of my friends formed back in 2006 based on some research we've been doing for the past couple of years before that on how to make an appliance that would make ASP.NET faster. Now, we were really looking even further afield of that, but we've come to realize that our particular set of skills is really well-suited to making .NET faster. We know a lot about it. And so the intuition and the thing we ultimately filed the patent for in the beginning was that if you put an appliance in front of the web servers, whether one or many, and you watch the traffic going back and forth, there are opportunities to optimize, to make things go faster, make the payload smaller, to do some caching, and make executions go faster, and so forth.
And when you're talking about an appliance, you're talking about an actual physical piece of hardware.
It's a physical piece of hardware.
It's not any software you're installing. It's actually just plug in the box, connect it up. And then how does it work from there?
Well, that's the magic of the whole thing, really, isn't it?
Don't give away any trade secrets.
Well, no, I mean, if you're going to try this thing out, and we're shipping. We've been shipping since November. You'll find out pretty quickly that you put the box in and you plug it into the network, and then it's got an MMC console plugin, so it's just like setting up IIS, really. And you point it to the web apps that you're concerned about. And give it some configuration settings of what it should be doing, and it literally will watch and learn. So one of the simple features, one that people can grab right away, is the view state treatment. So the view state treatment looks at the view state coming out of the page. It says, well, there's no reason for this to go to the browser. So it'll actually lift it out, replace it with a little token, something 8 bytes long, store it on the appliance. Page goes down to the browser like it always does. When you post back, it inserts the view state back in the page again. So the browser knows no different. Web server knows no different, but the page is smaller and faster.
So that's a case where you're keeping a lot of bytes off the network, and also the browser on the other end doesn't have to parse it and deal with it.
Well, and I mean, not that a browser does anything with view state,
right.
But it's a whole lot of page you didn't need. So, to get the features, you need it, but you don't actually need it down at the browser. So managing it properly is the tricky part because, you know, you can press the back button, you need another view state as well, right? Keep track of the old ones and so on. But we figured out how to do it right, and the consequence, as you said, is really a bandwidth savings more than anything else. We're making
right.
the payload smaller. Same reason you would use compression, which the box will do as well, or any of these other techniques. It's really about let's ship fewer bytes, so if bandwidth's a concern, that's significant. But also when we're dealing with bandwidth-constrained clients, you know, cutting half the page out makes a big difference
right.
in performance.
And bandwidth is still an issue. I mean, I personally at home, I've been lulled into a sense of, you know, fast internet connection because I've got a good provider and I'm very close to, my cable modem, provider and all that. So I get huge download bandwidths. But if I go to a Starbucks and connect to, a crappy wireless connection, I really feel the difference there.
You bet. And yeah, you're right. Connectivity varies all the time. So it depends on the app
right.
as to how important that particular trick's going to be. So where we get the really stunning performance improvements out of the AS1000 has been automated caching. That this box is able to learn what's cacheable, look at how often a given request, with all of its parameters, returns the same kind of response.
So you just said something that I really want to dive into with you, because you said the word performance, and we started saying we were going to talk about scalability.
Right.
And that's the number one thing that I think people confuse, or they use the terms, not confuse them, because I think when you ask somebody, they know the difference, but they use them almost interchangeably.
Absolutely.
And that was one of your first slides, because can you talk, what's the difference between performance and scalability?
Well, and to that point, no mortal, your CTO, the non-dev folk, there's never a non-dev person that's going to come to go, I think we got a scalability problem with the site. They always say the same thing, which is the page is too slow. So the normal way we find out about a scalability problem is first by having it described to us as a performance problem. The page is too slow. But the fundamental distinction here is that a performance problem is how fast is the page when there's one user on the site. Scalability problem is that the page is now slow because there's 10,000 users on the site. So when we're going to really address scalability problems, what I'm looking for is that the performance remains consistent from one user to 10,000 users or higher.
Right, and it comes down to perception as well because there's a lot of factors that goes into that scalability, right? They could just, it could be a slow network bandwidth day, right?
Absolutely.
The application may not be spiking on the CPU on the server, but there's something going on the network other than your application that's causing those perceptions.
And a big part of the talk at the beginning with the performance equation was really reminding everyone that there's more factors to making an application perform well than its bandwidth or even that server compute time. How long does it take to actually render on the page? You know, as developers, we tend to focus on server compute time because that's the stuff we did. And so naturally we're intend to blame ourselves, but in the demonstration that I did there, I showed pretty clearly, here's a page that's running at about 4.5 seconds, but over 2 seconds of that was pure latency, the trips back and forth to get all the image files and things. And so, you know, fixing your server compute time is just not going to have that much result.
Right. And oftentimes if you're, you know, if you're focused on, you know, 600 milliseconds versus 650 milliseconds, you know, it's like you're optimizing, you know, the smallest part of the, you know, of the whole throughput, right? And sometimes it can be something as simple as, well, our favorite icon was huge and, you know, we were pulling that down on each and every page view. I think Scott Hanselman said that he ran an analytics on his blog and found out that, you know, a third of his bandwidth is being, you know, chewed up by one image file that he had on the server.
I think it was his banner.
Yeah.
So, and therein lies this great issue of, if we have an application that's routinely used by the same people over and over again, browser caching offers us dramatic benefits. If we have an app that most people only ever visit once, browser caching is not going to do much for us. We only get the benefit on the subsequent requests. But it's well worth taking the time. It's just a configuration setting to start using some browser caching and cut down on those additional trips. And that has performance benefits all over the place. Less payload, fewer trips, you know, that's great big benefits.
Right. So, and as you're saying in your talk today this afternoon, is the one key that really stuck out for me is that not all caching is good either. So you kind of have to be aware of what you're doing. And, you know, it might be okay not to cache that particular piece because it's actually more of a hindrance than it helps.
Well, and I think that's where, you know, the programmer tendency is we get good at something, we want to do it a lot, right? You know, if you're good with a hammer, everything looks like a nail, and you're going to try and hit it down. And so often I've seen folks that get into these performance problems, and so they learn how to use data caching, and then they go berserk. They cache everything in sight. And next thing you know, they're running their web servers out of memory because their cache objects are so large. Or they're creating this churn where they're going through the process of caching that object, but the next request knocks it out of memory again. So they're perpetually repopulating anyway, and they really got no benefit from that.
Right. So it's kind of a topic I want to drill into a little bit is if you were to talk to, you know, web developers and kind of give them, you know, best practices or tips and tricks of what they can do to kind of protect themselves from getting too cache, I don't know, sloppy or heavy or, you know, whatever the term is. But essentially, what can web developers look at to make sure that they're building the most pristine applications they can possibly?
I think the starting point really is don't performance tune casually. And usually that's not that big of a surprise because we have to go to a lot of effort just to get permission to performance tune. You know, it's because you're not building features when you're doing that. And ultimately, the business owners, the domain owners, they're the guys who want new features. And here you are. Sure, performance has creeped to the top of the stack as a feature, but the actions, the work we have to do to performance tune is dramatically different than what we had to do to build features. So first thing is, you know, be stingy, be careful. Don't do this more than you absolutely need to. So that comes down to be systematic about what you're going to cache. Use the profiling tools. Studio comes with one. Use a profiling tool, figure out where you're spending your time so that the effort you're going to go to improve performance actually hits the things that need the performance boost the most.
All right. So it kind of brings me back to, like, when .NET first came out, I was on this particular project when, you know, still in beta, and we're trying to figure out what this .NET technology is, what it can do. And I remember back in the day where they were actually loading the states out of a database and populating a combo box.
Right.
And something like that. And so they were, you know, going to the database and, you know, give me all the states.
Because that's really volatile data, you know. we're adding states to the United States, like, just all the time. So that's
actually the point I want to make, is that they kept going to the database to get the states to populate the box, and they're like, hey, look, there's a session object. Let's just store that result set in the session object. And then I said, wait a second. How often does that data change? Like, never, maybe every 50 years or what, you know, whatever it is, right?
Until you guys annex Canada, I just don't think it's going to change again, right?
That's right. So they have to kind of be smart about what kind of data they're caching, how volatile is the data, and then to kind of take it from there.
I think you're hitting on two key points, which is that how big the cache item is, I think, is relevant. So states is, you know, nice and lean. And how often is it going to expire? And what's the consequences of that expiration? So I ran into an application that was like a newspaper. They publish new content at the end of each day, you know, right around midnight. Essentially, they're throwing out all of their cache items and reloading them with all new ones. And so it took about an hour or so to do that population. And during that hour, performance of the app was absolutely atrocious to the point where they were having, it was causing other problems. And what it, we realized is that they were completely dependent on caching. Yes, they were only changing their data once a day. But expiration was so costly that they literally couldn't run the app without everything being cached. And so ultimately what we ended up doing was building a mechanism that would generate a new set of cache items and then point to those once they were ready and continue to serve the old ones until they were ready, so that at no point was a user-sustained request actually hitting the database. They were always hitting the cache item.
Yeah, in that case, it's important to ask a lot of domain-specific questions, right? Like, you know, is it important that, you know, we always have the freshest item, you know, because I've actually talked and, you know, when you talk about insurance rates, it's very critical that you do the calculation correctly on an insurance rate, because otherwise you're going to give somebody a premium that's not appropriate, right?
Right.
But when you ask, how often does that change? And they go, oh, you know, once a quarter.
Yeah.
So probably something that you're not going to have to necessarily hit the database for on each and every request, right?
And even if we didn't get fancy and do that on the fly switchover, so one day out of the quarter, nothing's cached.
Right.
You know, the day that it's going to change, we turn off that caching mechanism and now we'll fetch from the disk until it has switched over and then we'll turn it back on the day after. Not an elegant solution, but it's a reliable one.
Absolutely.
And it means that, you know, 87 days out of the 90, we're running from cache data that's nice and fast.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit about the skills, because, you know, when your presentation, when you're up there, a lot of the things you were talking about weren't necessarily things that were specific to the .NET stack, right? So to do performance, you know, tuning, and also to understand scalability, you've got to kind of step out of your role as a developer and kind of understand network bandwidth, how things get load balanced. We talked a little bit about in your presentation about offloading SSL and just understanding how SSL certificates are calculated, you know?
Well, I think it's an interesting angle of this whole problem. We don't have a scalability problem in our test lab. When we build the code, we're not seeing the scaling problem. Scaling problems are an operations problem. They're only when the app's out in the wild. So the skills that even detect that we have a scaling problem aren't really oriented on development skills. They're operation skills. And so ultimately the skills it takes to treat them start at the operations level. And so one of the thoughts is, can we offload this problem? It's very easy for ops to just say it was the code, and very easy for the devs to say it was the environment. But when you actually get past that easy argument and start saying, what are we going to do this better? First, we diagnose. We figure out, hey, you know, 25% of our processing performance in this web server is going to making SSL encryption. Well, that's a big chunk. Now we're talking we need two or three more servers just to offset that. Maybe a dedicated SSL encryption device would take care of that problem. So thinking that way, looking at the big picture of what are the costs, how are we going to solve these things, suddenly the ops mindset of can we use hardware to solve this? And invariably, for me, for the most part, hardware is cheaper than development. Because hardware, we know what the cost is. And after we've bought it, it's still worth that. If you stick a couple of guys on a performance tuning effort, it takes 3 months. So you paid their salaries for 3 months, and that's $30,000-$40,000, right? So if you're paying these guys $5,000 each or $4,000 each a month, so $8,000 a month, that's $24,000 after 3 months. Hey, look, I do math.
Canadian dollars,
which are about the same as U.S. dollars these days. But now I'm looking at that number and saying, I don't know what the results are going to be from that. I'm going to spend that money. Those guys are going to go to that effort, and we don't know what the net benefit's going to be. So when you tell me I could buy an SSL offload appliance for $20,000, and try it out. And if it doesn't work, I'll send it back and get my money back. You can't do that with developers. You could try. Right. You know, you put 3 months into this development effort and you didn't get good results, so give us back your paycheck. I don't think that's going to fly.
You know, as a developer, you know, as a consultant for, you know, 12, 13 years, and, you know, as a developer, you're always like, oh, I can build that. You know, oh, I can build that. And I remember distinctively there was a point in time in my career where I was on a project, and I was talking with the project manager, and it was he brought it down to me to where I could understand it, where he's like, well, if you do it, it's going to cost this amount of money.
Right.
Or we can go and buy this tool that's like $10,000 because, you know, spending $10,000 for something sounds like a lot of money, but it's like, but if it cost you $20,000 to build it, we're actually saving $10,000.
We're actually ahead
of the
game.
And I'm like, I never thought of it that way. You know, it's like, you know, as a developer, you're just like, oh, I can build it. I can do that. You know, it's, and you kind of want that challenge to do it. But in the long run, it actually costs more money.
Well, and Billy Hollis says, we're addicted to code.
That's right.
Right? We go, just because we could build it, and I'm pretty sure we could, doesn't mean it's actually a good idea.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, you kind of touched on a point a couple minutes ago about, you know, how do you, if I'm a developer and we know we're building a large scale application and, you know, we're expecting, you know, to have the thousands of users and essentially the millions of users. We're building the next Twitter, let's say.
Right.
Right. What do you necessarily need to do? And maybe Twitter didn't do this very well and they're kind of learning as they're going along is how do you do capacity planning for around applications like that? As a developer, what are the things that you need to think of or who are the people that you should be talking to that may be part of your extended team to essentially make sure that your application will perform?
Well, and you hit on the key issue here, Dave, which is that capacity planning is not done by the developers, certainly by themselves. I would like a developer, preferably a senior developer, an architect, on my capacity planning team. But it's an ops issue, and it's a business issue. So I'm actually asking business, how many people do you think you're going to bring? And, okay, I'm going to plan, you know, if I'm going to plan for your 20,000 visitors simultaneously peak, it's going to cost this much. Are you prepared to spend that much? Well, we'd rather plan for 10,000 now. Okay, well, that's fine. And if we deliver 20,000, then we're prepared to fail. Because that would be, you know, excess success, right? When I was working as a consultant, you know, I'd lead off the conversation where they had this kind of failure with, well, congratulations. You know, you exceeded your own expectations for your app.
Yep.
More people liked it than you planned. That's a good problem to have.
It's a pleasant problem to have,
yeah,
right?
Because the alternative is nobody liked your app, and, yeah, it scales great for zero users.
So, you know, to go back to the development stack, right? You know, in ASP.NET developer, you know, because that's kind of what you know best, right? You know, short of, you know, like the hardware things, if I'm looking at my code, what are some of the things I can do? I mean, I'll lead you off with kind of what I'm talking about, that one of the things that I tell people is look at your view state. Are there controls on your page that you don't need to have view state enabled for? What are some of the other kind of tips and tricks that you could, you know, just looking at the .NET stack?
When we're chasing low-hanging fruit, I certainly think excess controls, you know, one of the evil things I see people get into the trap of is they use the repeater control to embed additional controls so that when they look at the basic page, it doesn't look that bad, but the actual rendered version is enormous. Certainly turning off view state where we don't need it. And sometimes the only way to do that is actually shut it off and play with it, find out if it does anything for you or not. Sloppy querying and repetitive querying. We get into this sort of built-up state where we have some includes or we have some base classes that we're referring to in every page, and those base requests are costly. You're redoing the authentication every page unnecessarily because you should be using a role object for that. There are better ways to handle those sorts of things. I find that you started out building a page that only queried once. You ended up with a page that had 9 separate queries in it. Maybe we should have rolled those together into a single multi-set query. I think that's where products like SharePoint get into trouble when we start customizing them, is that they have many, many data-centric queries on them that can't be combined easily. So I think, again, we get into this mindset of taking a step back. Let's look at the page as a whole and say, you know, what are we doing here that isn't really necessary? And we could have cut down on some of those requests, so we could have referenced those things from cache. When it comes to pure performance tuning, and I said this in the session as well, nothing beats caching. Caching will give you the largest performance benefit, but it has substantial costs. It has a price to be paid. It adds complexity to the code. It runs the risk of the data being out of date. I've got to figure out how often it's going to expire and how much I need to cache and so forth. So that's complicated.
So one of the things that, you know, we don't think of as, you know, .NET developers, you know, or architects is the things that we can do necessarily outside of our stack, you know, like, you know, content caching kind of on the edge of the network, like with Akamai.
Sure. The issues you run into there is that, of course, we always focus on our code.
Right.
You know, that's the stuff we wrote. But if you start looking at the whole of the problem, the operations problem, we don't have a scaling problem in our test lab. We don't have a scaling problem, you know, when we're building the code. It's only in operations that we see those problems. And that's where we got to sort of take a step back and say, what's possible here? And content delivery networks is a huge option there. You don't even need to go that far. I mean,
right.
If you just look at how IIS performs without ASP.NET, dedicated to serving up static files, it's a totally different product. It works really well that way. So someone going to the effort of trying to scale their app that way, let's move all the images onto a dedicated IIS box, A, they're going to receive some performance benefits. ASP.NET is just doing that. But also, if they do want to go to an Akamai, and it's not a cheap proposition to switch over to Akamai,
right.
They're already ready to go. But the other angle you get into here is this really, most folks talk about scaling from a distribution point of view. I'm going to buy more web servers.
Right.
They don't think about the specialization angles and things like dedicated image servers or going to content networks or even looking at dedicated SSL hardware and so forth. Those kinds of specializations give us two benefits. One is we're able to tune the gear really well to be able to get good performance out of that given task. But now we also are able to distribute, add more resources to only the things we need to improve the performance on. So maybe my web pages are being served just fine, but images aren't going as fast as they could. I can add more image servers, or I can only add to my ASP.NET servers and get more results for the amount of hardware that I bought.
Right. So, you know, kind of related to this, you know, and kind of this will be our last topic. We might ask a couple questions about
sure.
this, is in particularly the database, because we focused a lot on the code, you know, what you can do from a scaling out standpoint. And databases are notoriously bad for, you know, scaling out. You could certainly add hardware to them. And our DBAs love to have just one database, right? And oftentimes that's, you know, a limit of scalability, right?
Well, the moment we start distributing data, we run the risk of it being wrong. So, I mean, DBAs have that instinct because they've learned I want to store each piece of information exactly once. And databases are inherently specialized. We do that. We scale them up. We add more horsepower, more RAM, more disk space, external drive arrays, SANs. I mean, you can go a long way with a dedicated database. But sooner or later, you run into there's simply too many transactions going on, and they do have some distinct differences. So two different approaches that I've tried out using SQL Server in specialization for scaling out databases. And one is partitioning. So now I'm going to take a given table, and I'm going to split it across multiple servers. So one approach to that is a widely distributed one. I dealt with a company that had offices in Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York. Data center was in Chicago, which meant that performance was a problem for both the L.A. and New York offices. And what we quickly realized was that generally the L.A. folks were only looking at L.A. data.
Right.
And the Chicago folks look at Chicago data and so forth. So if we actually put full rigs, databases and servers and web services stuff in the LA office, they got much better performance, and they were nice and close to their LA data. So we partitioned that customer data across all three cities using WAN connections. Well, now for the majority of queries, they were only ever fetching local data and things were lightning fast. The month-end stuff now suffered because they had to aggregate across all of those servers and it took more time.
Right. But that's a once-a-month thing, like you were talking about earlier.
It's not as big a deal when you're only doing that once a month, and we can pre-run it, and it can afford to take a few hours. It's not a huge issue. And I would also point out this a few years ago. There are other technologies out there now, like database mirroring, that would make it easier for us to consolidate a copy of that data at Chicago if we wanted to.
For the month-end processing.
Sure.
Yeah.
And partitioning is not only just for distribution like that. You could also use partitioning in a local environment, so it would have multiple web servers, and they would share the work across a table. And it totally depends on the application where that makes sense. Or I might even want to just isolate individual tables and distribute across multiple databases that way. But I think the big one that folks get really excited about, and this is what you see in those big Web 2.0 apps, is distributing the reads from the writes. So now I want to have a centralized writing server, and that's all it does is all the writes go to it. And then I have a set of distributed reading servers. So they're getting replication feeds from the writing server, but otherwise they're just serving all the queries. So probably I have a larger number of reads to write servers because the reads are probably the thing that are causing me the most grief. Then I also get to specialize those things a bit more. I can add more indexes to the read servers, so they are really good at fetching data, and the write servers are far more focused on the constraint rules, making sure that the data is properly integrated and is correct. Now, the price I'm paying for all of that is latency. I write a record, and there's a certain delay before it's available on the read side. And so you've got to figure out if that's going to work for you. But you go to these big, big social networking sites, the MySpace of the world, that's exactly what they're doing. And that's why you see those latencies.
Exactly. And you could always use, like, you know, techniques like little Ajax on the front end to kind of disguise the latency, you know, that, you know, so you make the web page look like it. If you did a full page requery, it might not be there yet, but, you know, to the user, it is there.
Right. And keep them happy, you know, find ways to fake it out so that it's good enough for now. But certainly that offers big scaling advantages at the price of complexity. It's going to cost you in licenses. It's a more complicated way to work. But ultimately, you get that big scaling benefit.
So, you know, a lot of this brings up a lot of questions, and we'd love to have you back on the show at some point. We generally try to keep the show about 20, 30 minutes or whatever. You know, it leads to a lot of things. What about failover in these kind of situations? Now that you've got data spread everywhere and you've got, you know, information in different parts of the network, I'm sure that this you know, plays havoc with disaster recovery, right?
Yeah. Reliability is a whole other, you know, we talked about the scalability now. Yeah. Reliability, that's a whole other show.
Well, great. We'd love to have you back sometime.
Oh, you bet.
So, Richard, obviously we can find you at .NET Rocks.
Yes.
Run as Radio.
Run as Radio is the other show.
And you have a lot of speaking engagements coming up?
I travel a fair bit. So, next conference is coming up, Dev Teach in Toronto, the week of May 12th. I'm also going to be, I guess even before that, Dev Connections in Orlando. It's the third or fourth week of April. I'm committed to both weeks of Tech Ed US. So 1 week I'm going to be the .NET Rocks guy, the dev week. And then the IT week I'll be the run as radio guy. But, you know, I'll be there the whole time. And shows in the fall, too. I'm sure we'll be going to PDC. Got to do Dev Reach in Bulgaria.
Yep.
And also the SDC in the Netherlands. And I probably imagine we'll be at Tech Ed Europe as well.
So do you ever get a chance to relax at all?
I am relaxed.
Okay.
This is what I do for fun.
This is how you relax. Well, great. Well, it was great having you on the show, Richard. Thanks for joining Thirsty Bell.
Thanks, Dave.
So, Dave, I don't know about you, but I was a little intimidated by going up to Richard Campbell and asking him if we could record a podcast with him. Most people know him as the co-host of .NET Rocks, which is the most popular .NET podcast, you know, out on the internet. And so, you know, I was a little intimidated saying, you know, Richard, can you be on our little show? You know, we're pretty much, amateurs still at this. And he and, Carl Franklin are pretty much in the professional category at this point.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's essentially, he was telling us that's what Carl does, you know, pretty much full time now. You know, Carl used to have a training company, and I still think he does some training on the side and provides training content for other training companies. But, he's pretty much full time, you know, producing podcasts, you know, .NET Rocks and Mondays and some various other podcasts for other companies as well. And just sitting down with Richard, you know, we learned a lot, you know, obviously just, you know, based on the content that we were discussing about building scalable applications, but also he gave us some kind of handy tips and hints for recording podcasts as well. And we kind of learned a lesson when we recorded with Richard, didn't we?
We learned a hard lesson. I had left some previous interviews on the SD card in the portable recorder that we use when we're out. And, as a result, during the interview with Richard, when we were getting this great information from him, we actually filled up the memory card so the recorder, you know, quit recording at that point. You know, Richard was very cool about it. A lot of people would have said, well, you guys are, you know, kind of wasting my time. But he said, you know, this has happened to him before. So he gave us the opportunity to copy those files off, start with a clean slate, and we picked up the interview from where we had, where the recorder had quit recording.
Yeah, so maybe, you know, depending on how well we can sort of splice those together, we can see if our audience can figure out where that edit point is.
Maybe we'll cover it up pretty well. But
let's hope so.
You know, Richard's a great storyteller, you know. I mean, he's got, you know, again, we had a lot of conversations beyond what we actually recorded for the show. You know, I just love hearing him talk. I think that any subject, you know, that you can mention, he's got, you know, some, you know, a little bit of knowledge on it.
Right. Well, that's what he was telling us, that, you know, his family, you know, he comes from a family of storytellers. And, you know, when we stopped recording, we started getting onto some conversations around pharaohs of Egypt, which is quite interesting. You know, I'm not necessarily sure how you go from, talking about scalable web applications to the pharaohs of Egypt. But, you know, yeah, Richard, you know, he has a very passionate background in various, you know, different, subject matters for sure.
Yeah. And it was such a smooth transition, you know, going from, you know, Vue State and ASP.NET scalability to the pharaohs of Egypt. The only one I can name is King Tut, and that is based on the Steve Martin skit from Saturday Night Live in the 70s. Certainly not because I've studied.
That's right.
Should we go into a blog you should know?
Let's go into the blog you should know. So why don't you hit it off this time?
So one of the guys we got to talk to is our old friend Damon Payne when we were up in Milwaukee and deeper.net. Damon's actually been on our show, but we recorded, I think, episode 6 with him when it was Project Euler. And at the time, we weren't doing a blog you should know, so I think it's a good chance to kind of plug Damon's blog. He's got a really neat blog. He covers a lot of different topics, you know, here and there. Like I just checked today, and he's got a deep Zoom sample out there. But what I really like is lately he's been focusing on concurrency and parallel task development. You know, so how do we as developers take advantage of, you know, multi-cores? And even if you don't have multi-cores, how do you do background processing with threading? So I would point everybody to his blog, DamonPayne.com, and that's P-A-Y-N-E, and we'll put a link in the show notes, of course.
Great. So so the blog that I wanted to point out this week is actually LifeHacker.com. This is a very interesting site. It's kind of – it's the whole idea behind life hacking is, you know, making your life easier, right? So the LifeHacker.com actually points out, like, different tools, different tips, different tricks to kind of make your life easier. So just kind of going down the feed today, you know, there's – you know, just a warning, they do post a ton of content. So just be careful on how you you go about aggregating the site. Otherwise, you'll have, like, a you know, thousands of entries in your feed reader here. But essentially – you know, things like, you know, tracking and searching friend feed updates with Alert Thingy, which is like an air application that ties into friend feed. Are you familiar with friend feed at all, Larry?
I'm familiar with it, but I'm not on it right now.
Right. So the idea of friend feed is kind of like an aggregation of all your aggregators. So if you're on Flickr and Twitter and, you know, Pounce and, you know, all these services that provide some sort of RSS feed into your status, friend feed kind of aggregates all that and bubbles it up through different online, you know, these tools or online websites to kind of see what you're doing on these different social networks. But, you know, getting back to LifeHacker, you know, there's tips and tricks on how to create, you know, better photos for eBay. There's how to download YouTube videos in MP4 formats, and also, you know, keeping your reward card numbers on a cell phone and slimming down your wallet size. So there's various little tips and tricks, and they got some pretty interesting ones that come across the screen now and again. And, I would definitely, you know, check that out at lifehacker.com.
I liked your piece of advice there because I don't subscribe to LifeHacker, just because of the volume of, you know, updates that they do to the site. But I would say that it's at least once a week or once every 2 weeks that somebody points me to an article on LifeHacker. You know, that's how good the content is. And then when I'm there, I kind of peruse it, you know. So, maybe there's a LifeHacker tip on how to, subscribe to LifeHacker without getting overwhelmed.
Well, so I'll give you a tip of what I do right now. So I use NewsGator's FeedDemon as my aggregation tool for reading blogs. And there's two things that it has. One, it has something called a panic button, which is hilarious, by the way. So the idea is that the panic button will tell you, saying, hey, you have X amount of number of feeds that are unread. You know, panic because you can't read it all, right? So do you want to delete items that are older than, say, 5 days or 3 days or a week or 2 weeks? And it essentially gives you a nice little red panic button. You can hit the panic button, and it'll remove all the entries that are older than that certain amount of time that you specified. You can also go into each feed and actually say, keep the most recent, say, 50 items versus, you know, the most recent, you know, 500 items, right? So, you know, definitely when you have a tool like FeedDemon, you have more control over your kind of your feed reading, and that kind of helps me out quite a bit.
Well, Dave, next
also,
time
it works on the plane.
Next time we're together, you'll have to show me how that works, you know, because I use RSS Bandit. I'm pretty happy with it, but it doesn't have a panic button, and maybe that's what I need because I'm in the over 300 unread category right now.
Right.
So I'm in panic mode.
Yeah, what also is cool about it, and I'm not chilling FeedDemon here by any stretch of the imagination, but what's cool is you can have a watch, like watch folders. So if you subscribe to a number of different feeds and you want to set up some sort of keywords, I don't know, like Silverlight Development, let's say, it'll pull all those into that watch folder and pull out those feeds for you so you don't have to sift through everything as well. So that helps quite a bit as well. So it's a pretty cool tool. It's nice. And like I said, you can, you know, read your feeds on a plane as well. So it's a client tool that works on Windows and they have a comparable one that runs on the Mac as well. So it's a pretty interesting tool. So I would definitely recommend using that. So Larry, one thing I want to point out before we do wrap up is this whole Second Life launch thing. You want to talk about that a bit?
Yeah, Dave, our friend Zane Nabalsi, who's a developer evangelist down in the South Central District, he actually lives in the Dallas area, is actually putting together, with the help of a lot of other people, a Heroes Happen Here launch event, which, you know, we've talked about before. We had one in Chicago. We've got one coming up in Madison, Wisconsin this week. You know, the Heroes Happen Here is kind of touring around the U.S. They're actually creating a version of it available for people in Second Life. And Second Life is one of the virtual worlds. It's the most popular virtual world right now. And so they're going to deliver all the content that you would have in a normal Heroes Happen Here launch in Second Life.
Right. So actually there's, you know, Zane actually helps run a .NET user group in Second Life. The Second Life .NET user group, I think they meet every other Saturday or something along those lines. But so they've done this in the past where they've actually held user group meetings in Second Life. Now, I have to be honest with you. I don't necessarily get Second Life. It seems kind of creepy to me sometimes. But, you know, Zane is pretty passionate about it, and he thinks it's kind of like the wave of the future of how to reach larger audience, you know, both through, you know, a sort of pseudo virtual touch as well as kind of, you know, reaching out to them and engaging with them and not necessarily being in person with them. But you're kind of in person in this virtual world in a sense, which seems kind of strange to me, but also kind of intriguing as well. So I'm definitely going to check out the launch event, you know, in Second Life and just see how it goes. I'm actually interested from a technology standpoint about how they do this, right? So how do you kind of combine the virtual world with kind of, say, something like utilizing live meeting to present the content and be able to engage with individuals in Second Life, which I'm not quite sure what that means yet, but we'll soon find out.
Yeah, and there's a really long URL for how to, like, you know, join into the launch event in Second Life. We'll put it in the show notes. Just go to thirstydeveloper.com and check it out under episode 19.
Yep, sounds good. So I think we should wrap it up this week, Larry.
Sounds good, Dave.
All right, so with that, folks, thanks for listening. Once again, you can find us on iTunes or the Zune Marketplace. Just search for Thirsty Developer and you will find us. You can find myself at daveboss.com. I invite you over to my blog and invite you to subscribe to that. And you can subscribe to Larry's blog at larryclarkin.com. And also, you know, you can comment on each and every show if you go to our website at thirstydeveloper.com. And so with that, Larry, where else can they find us?
They can find both of us on Twitter and Facebook.
That's right. So with that, folks, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next week.
Segue me, baby.